Whenever we have opportunity to have Wesley Smith with us, we like to make the most of that opportunity. For the first 25 minutes of Issues Etc., our good friend Wesley Smith joins us from the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide. Several things we'll be discussing during the first 25 minutes. Another update on Terry Schindler Schiavo. We'll also be talking about the barrage of criticism that Leon Cass, who is chairman of the President's Council on Bioethics, has received of late and why. And we'll also talk about media bias when it comes to the coverage of adult stem cell research as opposed to embryonic stem cell research. Wesley has a little bit of personal experience with this, and we'll be talking with him about that in the first 25 minutes of the program. Open Lines runs from 3:30 to 4:30 today. Maybe, if we're fortunate today, we will have the opportunity to speak sometime in that hour with Carolyn Tuft or Bill Smith on the St. Louis Post-Dispatch story. Another story on Joyce Meyer Ministries, this time the St. Louis Dream Center. If you read the story about the possibility of some, if I'm not mistaken, some funds going to an abusive pastor, something like that, from the St. Louis Dream Center. We'll see what they have to say if we can get them on today. Open Lines. One of the questions I've got for you during Open Lines, among many other things, the Rush Limbaugh story continues to unfold. There's a story in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch via the South Florida Sun Sentinel. Officials seized Limbaugh's medical records in inquiry. I think it was Thursday last week when this story was announced by Limbaugh himself. During the execution of the search warrant, they searched several doctors' offices inquiring and obtaining Rush Limbaugh's medical records, in particular trying to find out whether or not he broke a law called a doctor shopping law in Florida. It's a felony, in fact, where people can seek prescriptions from many doctors simultaneously without telling the doctors about one another. And that way, you know, 1,733 hydrocodone pills, 90 OxyContin pills, 50 Xanax tablets, 40 Cadian pills from March to September of this year. Those are some of the things they discovered in just one pharmacist, one doctor's office. My question for you, we asked you for your reaction the week of Rush Limbaugh's return to the air, and now I'd like your reaction again. What do you think his future is in radio as this story continues to unfold? What is your reaction in general to his return, especially as now what appears to be a formal investigation seems to be underway? Felony charges, perhaps. That's Open Lines, and we'll also be talking about, let's see, Gene Robinson is meeting with a gay rabbi. They say God is doing something new. Joseph Lieberman seems to be switching back and forth on issues of religion. And then there's the please put your hands over your children's ears, the FCC's F-word ruling. We'll talk about that a little bit during Open Lines as well. Then, at 4:30, we'll be joined by Dr. James Hitchcock. He's going to join us to talk about The Da Vinci Code by Dan Brown, and also a big story here in St. Louis. Roman Catholic politicians and the new Archbishop of St. Louis, apparently in La Crosse, Wisconsin, where he served before, he was bold enough to write to Roman Catholic politicians saying, look, if you are going to hold views contrary to the Roman Catholic Church on the issues of life and other things, don't come to communion. And he says in the paper that he might write similar letters here in St. Louis when he takes his post. We'll get the thoughts of Dr. James Hitchcock a little later on Issues Etc. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Wesley Smith is a regular guest here on the program. He's an attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide. He's a senior fellow for the Discovery Institute and author of several books, including Culture of Death, The Assault on Medical Ethics in America. Wesley, welcome back.
Hi, Todd.
Wesley, I have to start out by saying I got an email just this weekend from a listener who had nothing but good things to say about you and your work, especially when it comes to this Terry Schiavo case.
You know, and my cousins are everywhere, Todd.
on the payroll. But especially with your work relentlessly and tirelessly bringing the Terry Schiavo case back to the thoughts of the public in the many different fora in which you write.
Well, thank you. I find myself like Jeremiah. My bone marrow was on fire if I try to shut up.
Let's get an update on Terry, if we could. What's the latest?
Well, the latest is the rule of Terry's case continues. Pat Anderson, the attorney for the Schindlers, calls this the rule of Terry's case. If a procedural ruling will make it so Terry will die, then the court will follow the proper procedure. If the proper procedure would mean that Terry would live longer, the court will not follow the proper procedure. We've seen that happen, for example, with the lawsuit against Terry's law, in which Governor Jeb Bush was sued. In Florida law, the governor is supposed to be sued in Tallahassee, which is the capital, so that the governor's counsel doesn't have to chase all over the state to answer lawsuits. Governor Bush was not sued in Tallahassee. He was sued in St. Petersburg in the same little court area, where the same circuit, where Terry Schiavo case seems to be in what I'm calling an audio loop tape, you know, tape loop, where you just keep getting the same judges and the same appeals court making the same decisions. Now, when the governor said, wait a second, this is against the law, I'm supposed to be sued in Tallahassee, they said, tough, you got to answer anyway. See, that was the rule of Terry's case. And another situation with the governor moving forward, having to defend in a jurisdiction he shouldn't have to appear, he sought to begin discovery, that is, trying to get the facts of the case and present evidence. And the courts have said you shall conduct no discovery in this case, at least for now, because the judge, Judge Baird, ruled before the governor filed any documents. Judge Baird publicly stated that Terry's law is presumptively unconstitutional. Now, a normal judge, if he had, for example, Judge Scalia, in the Pledge of Allegiance case, had made a speech in which he talked about God and the Pledge of Allegiance. And when he was asked to recuse himself because he'd made a statement prior to that case coming to the Supreme Court, he said, yes, you're right, I have the appearance of prejudging the case, so I am recusing myself from the case. This judge certainly has the appearance of prejudging the case, having decided before he sees the governor's papers that the law is unconstitutional, so you would think that this judge would do the same thing. That would be proper procedure. The appearance of a conflict of interest in a judge requires the judge to recuse himself, even if he has not actually prejudged the case. Oh, no, the rule of Terry's case applied. The judge refused to recuse himself. And so we are stuck in that same tape loop where the same circuit continues to make the same rulings about Terry Schiavo going to the same court of appeals. And it's a self-fulfilling prophecy in a sense.
Terry's guardian ad litem issued a report. We heard a bit about it last week. Bring us up to date. In particular, Jay Wolfson is the actual guardian ad litem, I take it.
Right.
This is a mixed bag, the report of this guardian.
Well, it's a mixed bag, and I was heartened that it wasn't just a totally bad bag, because Jay Wolfson is a public health lawyer and academic professor. He's well-known in bioethics circles, and most bioethicists believe that Terry Schiavo should not be living any longer. He pretty much touted the establishment line here in terms of what the case is. He says he believes that Terry's in a persistent vegetative state, although he admitted he did visit her quite a bit, and he admitted he saw times when she appeared to react, but it wasn't consistent all the time. Well, that's putting a requirement on Terry that Florida law doesn't put a requirement on. That aside, he did suggest that she would benefit from a swallowing test, which is a very good piece of news. But what got my gall, if you will, was this continuing refusal on the part of those who want Terry to die that her husband, Michael, who is making her health care decisions, has basically abandoned his marriage by living with another woman for many years, committing himself to that woman, having two babies with that woman. In essence, if this were a divorce case, we would be able to say that he had abandoned his wife. Yet, even though he now has a new love, he's in love with someone else, he's moved on, he has a new family, people are still saying, in fact, there was even a poll in Florida, who should have the decision, and people thought Michael, because he's only described as a husband. And in 38 pages, this guardian ad litem never once came to grips with the fact that Michael Schiavo has a new family.
Is it within the purview of the guardian ad litem to address that very issue?
He addressed every other issue in the case. He looked at everything else that was going on, whether there was a financial conflict of interest, whether or not she was really PVS. And he said that I am standing in the shoes of Terry Schiavo. Well, if you're standing in the shoes of Terry Schiavo, which means you're trying to, as best you can, determine what she would want if she were able to express herself, I think that you have to come to grips with this issue. Would Terry want a man who now has a new family to decide her fate, or would she want her parents, who have remained loyal to her since 1990, when she was injured, to decide her fate? It seems really clear to me that she would want her parents. Why would you want a husband who no longer is involved with you but has another family to decide? And he refused to grapple with that, because it's difficult to grapple with that once you come to the realization, that he is no longer solely loyal to his wife but has a whole new set of responsibilities and intimacies. Well, then suddenly the whole complexion of the case changes. That's why the New York Times has almost never reported the fact. The Washington Post doesn't report it. The Florida papers never report on it when they castigate Governor Bush for stepping in and saving Terry's life. It's inconvenient to the thesis that Michael should be allowed to decide that Terry should be dead.
So in other words, if the Guardian ad litem, Jay Wolfson, were to take up the subject of whether or not Michael Schiavo has been demonstrating through his actions over the last decade himself to be a fit guardian according to the original specifications of this whole case that Michael brought.
Right.
If he were to take this up, that would call into question pretty much everything that's happened in the last decade.
Yes, exactly. And particularly given some of the care he has not provided for Terry, not giving her the therapy that he told the medical malpractice jury he would provide her. There were some mistakes in the Guardian's report. He said that Michael provided aggressive therapy through 94. My understanding is that the medical records do not indicate that the medical therapy stopped in the middle of 91 when they ran out of health insurance money. It's real clear he's never used the $750,000 for that. And there are now attempts to get Jay Wolfson to demonstrate where that 1994 date came from. But beyond that, it's uncontroverted that right now there are very qualified medical experts who say that Terry could benefit from therapy. And the one good thing in this report is he said, well, let's give her a swallowing test and see what happens. Because he says if she can swallow, which means she'd be able to eat by mouth, then he does not recommend that the tube-supplied food and water be removed. That is a crucial point in this case.
So where does her case stand right now? How would you describe it? I know it's always kind of in this, as you said, the continually repeating loop of tape, but how would you describe Terry's case right now?
She remains on the precipice. She is in the short term, she's safe from dehydration. That doesn't mean she's necessarily safe from other medical problems, because Michael Schiavo remains in complete control of her decision-making. And let's say she gets a serious infection, he probably would not treat her with antibiotics. Parents are desperately trying to get Michael kicked out as guardian and putting themselves in, and the judge, Greer, seems very slow. He's moving at a glacial pace to get that case to trial, although he did refuse to dismiss it. Terry's law is hanging by a tender hook, because the judge who's going to rule whether or not it's unconstitutional has already indicated it's unconstitutional before he even saw the governor's papers. That case, once he decides that, assuming I'm right that that's what he'll decide, goes to the same court of appeals that has several times ordered Judge Greer to order the dehydration. So that's the situation we're in. On the other hand, in talking to Pat Anderson once, she was complaining rightfully about the rule of Terry's case. I pointed out that the other rule of Terry's case is that for all of these machinations, Terry's still alive. So there's also an investigation being conducted by a disability rights group that is federally funded that has a power here to see whether there's been abuse or neglect in Terry's care, and I have some hope for that investigation. Because if you look at somebody not given physical therapy for years, not given rehab, not giving swallowing tests, not having her teeth cleaned, I think you can demonstrate some neglect, if not abuse.
Wesley Smith is our guest. He's an attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide, senior fellow for the Discovery Institute. You've written recently also about Dr. Leon Cass, who is, among other things, a university professor, presidential advisor. He's the chairman of the President's Council on Bioethics, a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. This is a man whose qualifications are pretty much unparalleled. Why does he drive so many in the bioethics community crazy?
as I put it in my recent article, Into Teeth Grinding Rage. They are very upset because Cass, he is now the most prominent bioethicist in the world because of this appointment, but he does not, his views are not in accord with the mainstream thinking in bioethics. Cass is a very eloquent defender of inherent human dignity. He believes that life has importance and matters morally simply because it's human. Bioethicists, for the most part, disagree with that vehemently. They think it's an act of discrimination against animals called speciesism, and they believe that what gives a life or an organism value is having certain cognitive capacities. If you have sufficient capacities, you're known as a person, and persons have what you and I would call universal human rights. But people who are not cognitively don't reach that level of cognitive capacity. People like Terry Schiavo, for example, in predominant bioethics thinking, are no longer persons. And therefore, not only do they not have the right to life, but they don't necessarily have the right to bodily integrity. Many bioethicists believe that people like Terry should be exploited for their organs.
So what kind of reactions have you noted to Leon Cass, the things that he's said and the things that he has written?
Well, there's just, you know, bioethicists like to pretend that they're these rational, dispassionate, discussers of important moral issues. But they're very emotional and they're very ideological. And the attacks on Cass have been anything but dispassionate and have not been necessarily rebuttals of his positions. They've been diatribes, emotional diatribes. And what I wrote about in this National Review Online article, Cass and the Firing Line, was an article by a man named Glenn McGee, who's a big bioethicist at the University of Pennsylvania. He's often seen on television, Larry King Live, and those kinds of shows. He's actually been on TV to come in about the Terry Schiavo case, and you know which side he came down on. He is the editor-in-chief of a journal called the American Journal of Bioethics, which is a pretty big bioethics publication. And he accused Leon Cass in this editorial of being akin to this fictional movie assassin named Leon the Assassin. And he calls, and he was just really upset because Leon Cass has forced, through the power of his intellect, the issue of human dignity into the debates over human cloning. And so McGee has this fit, this incredible diatribe of invective against Leon Cass, rather than saying where Cass might be right or wrong in terms of arguing the position. It's just this almost a name calling. I mean, to compare Leon Cass to an assassin, even though it's a fictional assassin, is ludicrous.
He is referred to him. No, I'm sorry. This would have been. They're calling.
He called Leon. He said Leon Cass. He called him akin to Leon the Assassin, which is in a movie. Maybe it's Mona Lisa or something. I forgot the name of the movie. But he said, of course, Leon Cass wouldn't kill people. But in essence, he said that he's akin to this kind of a character and that he's a destroyer.
So then this is just terribly and sadly ironic, because what Leon Cass is actually calling for is the preservation of the moral dignity that is inherent in human life.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It's irrational.
Okay.
It's not rebutting Leon in a rational way. It is name calling, and this is how he starts the. I quote the opening of the piece. This is what he says in the opening of his editorial, Glenn McGee. It has become the era of Leon Cass, brought back to scholarly life as if he ever left it, by a call from President George W. Bush. It was a call to become a presidential bioethics advisor as head of the President's Council on Bioethics, in the service of putting a stop to embryonic stem cell research and, if possible, putting a stop to a number of other scientific and clinical projects objectionable to the far right wing of the Republican Party and, in particular, Southern Baptists.
It's kind of funny because Cass isn't Southern Baptist.
Cass is Jewish. George Bush isn't Southern Baptist, and neither one of them, for better or worse, has ever called for the outlawing of embryonic stem cell research. They've called for the outlawing of human cloning, and George Bush put a limit on federal funding of embryonic stem cells, but this is just nonsense.
So is there a method to the madness here of all these who are writing about Leon Cass and denigrating not only his scholarship but also his position? Is there a method to their madness?
Well, I believe so because, and this is what I wrote, if we deconstruct the moral importance of human life, then there can be no such thing as a definitive right and wrong. Universal moral principles that control how we are to treat people, or indeed any reason at all for believing that humans are not just another species of animals in the forest. Once we reach that point, Todd, anything becomes possible because the very idea of inherent human dignity has been obliterated. And one of the things that I have been most alarmed about, both with the bioethics movement and with animal liberation movement, is that both those movements, for different reasons, are seeking to push humankind off the pedestal of exceptionalism and make us just another animal in the forest. And if we ever just see ourselves as another animal in the forest, in essence, meat on the hoof, then that's exactly how we'll treat each other.
Before we go to this break, we've got about 3 minutes. Describe your recent experience with a little bit of media bias on the issue of adult stem cell research.
That's funny. I went to Kentucky and participated with Dr. David Prentice, who's a brilliant adult stem cell researcher. I urge you to have him on your show sometime because he can really let your audience know all of the ins and outs of the latest in terms of adult stem cell successes. And a moral philosopher named John Hubert. And we gave a 2.5-hour seminar on human cloning. Kentucky is going to try to outlaw human cloning in the state in the coming legislative session. And we spent a great deal of time, at least a third of the time, talking about these adult stem cell breakthroughs. Well, the Courier Journal from Louisville was there, and they covered the event, supposedly. But other than saying that I opposed stem cell research under my picture, they didn't report, which I then had to write a letter to the editor about. They didn't report what I said, what Prentice said, or what Hubert said at all. Instead, they reported on what the people from Kentucky, University of Kentucky, said about therapeutic cloning and saying that therapeutic cloning offers the best hope, right, for these research breakthroughs, without once mentioning adult stem cells, which we'd spent almost an hour discussing in quite detail and specifically citing the peer-reviewed science journal articles that demonstrate the truth of this. So, I mean, it's like there's a self-censorship here in the news. They wouldn't let the listener or the readers know what we said because they had people rebut what we said without reporting what we said, and then said therapeutic cloning offers the best hope here for these regenerative medical treatments when we spent at least 45 minutes describing in detail the adult stem cell research breakthroughs happening in humans and animals that are demonstrating that we don't need cloning. So that was it was a news blackout for the readers of the Courier Journal of what actually took place in that event.
Wesley, can we have you for a few minutes on the other side of this?
Sure. Break?
Thank you very much. Wesley Smith is our guest. When we come back, I would like him to lay out some of the things that didn't get reported on, in particular, some of the breakthroughs that are being experienced in the research community with adult stem cell research that show the fact that embryonic stem cell research, for all of its false promise, is simply unnecessary. And then I'd like Wesley's response to a quote here I found just recently from a prominent Christian theologian of the liberal bent who says that a world bright enough to create the opportunities to extend life is bright enough to control those who might misuse them. We'll be right back.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Do you think Christian parents should avoid the subject of Santa Claus with their children? Did you know that the real St. Nicholas was a 4th century pastor? But did he really live at the North Pole and distribute gifts on Christmas Eve? How do we separate fact from fiction? Issues, Etc. and Concordia Publishing House recommend the new children's book, St. Nicholas, The Real Story of the Christmas Legend. The book costs $12.99 plus shipping and handling. For more information, call Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. Or you can browse before you buy. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, and under the What's New section, you'll find information on St. Nicholas by Julie Stiegemeyer. The book contains museum-quality artwork with family-friendly language. issuesetc.org or 1-800-325-3040. St. Nicholas, The Real Story of the Christmas Legend, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for December.
Now this Global Minute lets you hear about a unique way to celebrate the Christmas season. Pray for people who don't know Jesus Christ. Greg Parsons is executive director of the U.S. Center for World Mission in Pasadena, California. And he says adopting unreached people for prayer is a project an entire church can do.
But a church as a whole, or if it's a large church, a fellowship group or a cell group of a church, would seriously take on a particular people group, a particular unreached people group that does not have the gospel, and say, we're going to pray for them, and we're going to give if we can. And if our church is big enough, we want to see someone from our church maybe go.
There are several thousand unreached people groups in the world today. They're found mostly in the Middle East, Central Asia, and South Asia. Pray for more Christians to adopt unreached people for prayer. Learn more by logging on to missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. What did the United States do on this day in 1941, the day after the attack on Pearl Harbor? The answer is obvious. We declared war and entered into years of battles, years of killing, years of mourning for loved ones lost. President Roosevelt did not ask for a resolution of Congress to send missionaries and Bibles to Japan. Ecclesiastes 3 says, there is a time for everything, and a season for every activity under heaven, a time to kill and a time to heal. In current debates, people ask what we are leaving our children and grandchildren. Are we leaving them a burdensome debt, heavy taxes, a polluted environment, an oppressive government bureaucracy? Supreme Court Justice Sutherland wrote in a 1931 decision, we are a nation with a duty to survive, a nation whose constitution contemplates war as well as peace, and submission and obedience to the laws of the land, as well those made for war as those for peace, are not inconsistent with the will of God. St. Paul said it this way in Romans 13, verse 4, the government does not bear the sword for nothing. I'm Dale Meyer.
Hi, this is Chuck Rathert, host of the Bible Study and program director for AM 850 KFUO. It's a privilege for me to extend an invitation to our wonderful listeners to come to our very special open house on Sunday, December 14th from 1:30 till 3:30 in the afternoon. Your favorite AM 850 KFUO personalities will be on hand. Together, we'll mark the occasion of KFUO's 79th birthday. I hope you can join us Sunday afternoon, December 14th, for our AM 850 KFUO open house.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. Wesley Smith has been kind enough to agree to stick with us for a few more minutes, a few subjects to wrap up with Wesley. And then I'd like to talk to you a little bit about some very pressing needs we have here at Issues Etc. before we go on for Open Lines Issues Etc. Wesley, you were telling us before the break how it is that the media bias operated, at least down in Kentucky, with a seminar that you attended. Tell us some of the things about adult stem cell research that simply did not get reported by the press down there.
Well, for example, in the Courier Journal report, they said that therapeutic cloning may lead to cures of Parkinson's disease. And in our discussion, we cited two examples of Parkinson's experimental treatments that have already helped human patients using adult stem cells or other factors. For example, the brain function in five human patients with advanced Parkinson's disease was partially restored by a natural body chemical known as glial-derived neurotrophic factor. Don't expect me to tell you what that is. But what they did was they used this chemical that is part of the glial nerves, or they're like nerve cells. You have them in like in the nose, olfactory nerves, and so forth. They apparently used this chemical and put it in these patients, and they had partial remissions, and three of the patients had their senses of taste and smell restored. This is exciting news, and to not report that when you say that therapeutic cloning might do that, you know, we're talking decades, if at all, I think was journalistic malpractice. In another case, a man named Dennis Turner, and I've interviewed Dennis Turner, and I believed I've described his progress on your show. He had Parkinson's, still does. He had a pea-sized piece of his brain removed by a Dr. Levesque out of Cedars-Sinai Hospital in Los Angeles. They removed the neural stem cells from the pea-sized brain, proliferated the stem cells in culture into the millions, put them back into Mr. Turner, and Mr. Turner has had almost a complete remission of his Parkinson's disease. Now, one patient does not a cure make because you don't know for sure that he would have gone on to develop the severe Parkinson's which was expected of him. By now, he's supposed to be, if the disease progressed as expected, in a wheelchair under severe medication. He's on very limited medication, and when I interviewed him, he was about to go to the South Seas on a photographic expedition looking for great white sharks. So, I mean, there's tremendous advances being done. Bone marrow stem cells and blood stem cells in humans are now beginning to rebuild damaged heart tissue. There was an experiment down in Brazil with 5 patients needing heart transplants received their own bone marrow stem cells. Only one now needs a heart transplant. There was a case here in Michigan of a young man shot in the heart with a nail gun, a nail in a nail gun, and then he had a heart attack. He's been given his own blood stem cells, and his rate of his heart is regaining the ability to pump blood. The FDA now is forcing those researchers to go back to animal testing. But it demonstrates what's going on. And in mice, diabetic mice, juvenile onset diabetes type 1, has been completely cured in mice by using cells from the, what's the name of that organ? I'm sorry. From the spleen.
Spleen.
Yes, and they've had complete cures in terms of getting off insulin and so forth. And now they're about to start human trials. That's really important news, and that is a very germane issue in dealing with whether or not to permit human cloning and so forth. And to cover an event and have so much specific descriptions of advances in adult and alternative non-embryonic stem cell research and not report one word about it to your readers is propaganda, not journalism.
Finally, Wesley, I'd like your reaction. This is a quote I came across recently from one John Shelby Spong, who is...
Well, John Shelby Spong, by the way, is a bishop in the Episcopalian Church, but he believes that Christianity needs to stop being theistic.
So yes, he has written, among other things, and he's making the case in favor of what he calls death with dignity, in favor of good deaths through euthanasia. This is what he says. A world that is bright enough to create these opportunities, that is... euthanasia opportunities.
Is
surely bright enough to control those who might misuse them.
Well, you know, that's just utter pap. I mean, this is a man who clearly is not thinking deeply, and he hasn't studied the subject. If you take a look at the Netherlands, for example, we find that in the name of helping very ill and people near the end of life have a peaceful death, doctors are now killing babies born with birth defects. They kill at least 1,000 people who haven't asked to be killed per year. It's called termination without request or consent. The Dutch Medical Association, it's technically murder in Dutch law. Now they want to make that legal, too. They killed people who were depressed and not physically ill. They killed disabled people who asked for it, chronically ill people who asked for it. That is just the raving nonsense of a person who is emotionally liberal, but has no sense of looking deeply into the issue and checking out the facts. It's not empirically based. It's ideologically driven.
Wesley Smith, thank you again for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd. Talk to you again.
Wesley Smith is an attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide, a senior fellow for the Discovery Institute, author of several books, including Culture of Death, The Assault on Medical Ethics in America. You can read several columns written by Wesley Smith on the web at WesleyJSmith.com. It's all one word, WesleyJSmith.com. Where else on radio will you hear life defended from beginning to end, as you do here on Issues, Etc.? Where else will you hear guests of the quality of Wesley Smith on, sometimes on a weekly basis, bringing you updates on things like Terry Schiavo and adult stem cell research, all of these things? That's why we are able to say with a completely straight face here on Issues, Etc., that one of our major tasks is defending life from beginning to end. If you appreciate, and I mentioned at the beginning of our conversation with Wesley, someone who had recently written me, and I get letters like this all the time, praising issues, etc., and thanking us effusively for having guests like Wesley Smith on and the many other guests that we bring to you on the issue of life. If you're one of those people, I would like you to consider being a supporter of Issues, etc., with a year-end tax-deductible gift. We also have another opportunity for you, and that is, and this is new, monthly giving to Issues, etc. We have three levels for monthly giving. The first level is a confessor. That's $25 a month or an annual gift of $250. In thanks for that gift, you will receive a subscription to the Issues, etc. journal, an Issues, etc. tape of the month, and a copy of Craig Parton's book, The Defense Never Rests. The next level up is called The Apologist. That's $50 a month or an annual gift of $500. In thanks for your generous support at that level, we will give you all the benefits of being a confessor, plus a quarterly Issues, etc., book of the month. That's four books total for the year. And at the level of the Reformer, which is $100 a month or an annual gift of $1,000, you'll get all of the benefits of being the confessor and the apologist, plus three Issues, etc., journal subscriptions, two Issues, etc., tapes of the month, a written transcript. This is something also brand new. A written transcript of each Issues, etc., tape of the month, and an Issues, etc., book of the month for all 12 months of the year. The levels are confessor, apologist, or reformer. Also, in addition to this, many of the affiliates that run the national program of Issues, etc., run the program on tape delay. It's actually a CD. Now, this costs money. We need to produce these CDs and also send them out. That's why we're looking for a one-time major gift of $4,000 to help support the CD production and mailing for all of our tape affiliates nationally on Issues, etc. Here are the ways you can give. First of all, you can give online at our website, issuesetc.org. Go there, click on the What's New section. You'll find information on everything I've told you about. Or you can call our automated resource line, 1-800-737-0172. One more time, 1-800-737-0172. 1-800-737-0172. Someone will be taking your donations live in the next 2 hours. It's also automated on the off hours, 1-800-737-0172. Or you can mail in a check. Write it to Issues, etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. That's Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. If you'd like to be the one-time major donor of $4,000 to support our CD production and mailing for our tape delay affiliates, make sure you put on the check, Issues, etc., CD Fund. It's open lines for the remainder of this hour and into the next. Rush Limbaugh has been back for some weeks now, hasn't he? Thursday last week, we were sitting here in the studio getting ready to go into the third hour, I believe, and we heard over the news a bit of sound from Rush Limbaugh in which he said his medical records were being seized. Now, the story in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch fills in the details. A Palm Beach County Law Enforcement Task Force has seized Rush Limbaugh's medical records from three doctors as it investigates whether the radio commentator illegally obtained prescription painkillers, according to search warrants made public Thursday last week. Authorities are looking into whether Limbaugh violated the state's doctor shopping law in order to get doctors to write overlapping narcotic drug prescriptions for him and failing to tell the doctors about one another. That's illegal in Florida, by the way. Records from one pharmacy near Limbaugh's Palm Beach mansion show that during a six-month period this year, he picked up hundreds of addictive painkiller prescriptions, and he used four local doctors to do so. Now, nothing is conclusive. Some people have more than one doctor. The question is whether or not this violates the doctor shopping laws in Florida. From March to September, Limbaugh picked up over 1,700 hydrocodone pills, 90 OxyContin pills, 50 Xanax pills, tablets, and 40 Cadian pills, a time-release morphine, the search warrant indicates. Limbaugh would get different doctors' prescriptions for painkillers within a single week. Doctor shopping is a third-degree felony under Florida law, punishable by up to 5 years in prison. Now, he has read on the air a statement of his lawyer, Roy Black, saying what should be a responsible investigation is looking more and more like a fishing expedition. What these records show is that Mr. Limbaugh suffered in extreme pain and had legitimate reasons for taking pain medication, Black's statement said. Unfortunately, because Mr. Limbaugh's prominence and well-known political opinions, he's being subjected to an invasion of privacy no citizen of this republic should endure. And other than that, Russia's remaining pretty much moot on this subject. So there is an investigation that was hinted at before Rush went into rehab. He came back from rehab, went right back on the air, literally the next day went back on the air. At that time, I asked for your reactions to the return of Rush Limbaugh. I asked for them again now as the story unfolds and as some time has passed. It's open lines 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Do you agree with the attorney for Rush Limbaugh that this is simply an invasion of privacy that no person should have to endure? Or is this the kind of thing you got to look into when you've got someone who has got four doctors on the line, multiple pharmacies, and these numbers of pills, in addition to what has been indicated in the press about drugs that were being procured by Limbaugh through his housekeeper, larger numbers of drugs, illegally? Have you noticed a difference in Rush as a radio talk show host? In terms of the broadcasting, is it as good as it was before? I was quite frank with you at the week of his return. I said, I think he sounds a little dreamy. Not because of drugs, but because of just coming out of rehab. He talked about no one being responsible for his own happiness and how he had to think about himself first, and it sounded very un-Rush-like. Do you think that Rush Limbaugh will continue to gain more popularity, or is he on the downward slope of his career? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Now, we ask these questions because we know that many people who listen to this program are also big fans of Rush Limbaugh, as I am. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Let's see, where do I want to go? Oh, yes. Now, we are coming to you live. It's Monday, the 8th of December, and it is open lines. Here's the story that I haven't talked about yet because at first I found it hard to believe. I'm sure you've heard about it. Now, let me warn you before we go any farther, if you have young children in the back seat, turn the radio down a little bit if you want to keep listening, or if you cannot listen to this without and not want to ask uncomfortable questions or answer uncomfortable questions, just feel free to turn it off. The FCC issued a ruling October 3rd. Did you hear about this? It was in response to some complaints that it had received about the Golden Globe Awards that were held January 19th, 2003, right at the very beginning of the year, in which Bono, big U2 singer, you know who we're talking about here, used the F word in several rather flagrant occasions. I think twice he used the F word. The FCC says, after ruling on this, this was not a violation of obscenity or indecency laws because it didn't describe what the word normally is used to describe. It was used as a colorful addition. Well, this has definitely piqued the ire of many. The story from the Agape Press reads as follows. Scores of elected officials in Congress are, in effect, calling for the FCC, calling them on the carpet for its recent decision that uses the F word over the public airwaves, and it does not, and its ruling that it does not constitute indecency or obscenity. Representatives of the Federal Communications Commission met Thursday with members of the House Committee on Energy and Commerce, which oversees the federal agency, to discuss that very issue. There are two letters that have come out of Congress, signed by many representatives, basically asking the FCC to reconsider this ruling. If you turn on cable, you're already hearing the word either bleeped or unbleeped on a regular basis. If you turn on the radio, you sometimes hear it bleeped as well. The FCC says, look, unless it's used in a certain way to describe certain actions that are borne upon by the laws that govern indecency and obscenity, if it's just used in a kind of a generic way, then it's not indecent and it's not obscene. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Gene Robinson, of course, is most famous for this summer's consecration as the first openly gay bishop in the Episcopal Church USA. According to the LA Times, he met recently with the first Orthodox rabbi to publicly declare his homosexuality. They met in Los Angeles Thursday night for an evening of conversation with 50 guests. The Right Reverend Gene Robinson and Rabbi Steven Greenberg of the National Jewish Center for Learning and Leadership in New York, they met for a wide-ranging discussion about sex and religion. The men said that they shared similar struggles in attempting to reconcile traditional religious taboos against homosexuality with their once secret sexual attraction to men. Robinson said, "Neither of us set out to do something historical. I think God is doing the historic thing. Something new in the culture and with religious people." This isn't the first time, by the way, that Gene Robinson has said this. God is doing something new. First, it was God getting Christians to recognize the equal rights of minorities, of different races. And then it was God getting people to recognize the equal rights and status of women. This is the logic he uses, by the way. And now God is doing a new thing, getting people to recognize that homosexuality is no different from anything else we've come to approve of. Rabbi Greenberg said, "When Gene and I talk, we keep shaking our heads. Yes, that's right. There's a real sharing on both sides of the sense that this issue is much larger in reality than the specific concerns of gay and lesbian people. What we are really aiming toward is a picture of religious life that in itself is more responsive to the human condition and yet takes religious tradition, very seriously." After years of internal struggle, Greenberg, 47, disclosed his sexual orientation in 1999. A year later, he was prominently featured in a documentary film, Trembling Before God, about gay and lesbian Orthodox Jews. Robinson told the group that he has been called the most dangerous man in the Anglican Communion. "I'm told I'm dangerous because I can't be written off." Greenberg said it is clear to him that, quote, "we are at the transformation of Western culture, a fact that the opposition seems to irrationally say to me, we are in the last gasp of patriarchy." Anyone who thought that Gene Robinson would just go quietly about his business should think again. It's open lines, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Meanwhile, Gallup is reporting that Americans are quite religious. They take their religion very seriously. Most attend their place of worship at least monthly, of those who do attend. It's a very present reality in American society. Religion in general, of course. We're not talking about any specific religion. Roughly 6 in 10 adults told Gallup in a mid-November survey that religion is very important in their lives. Close to 2/3 say that they are members of a church or a synagogue, and more than 4 in 10 say that they attend a church or a synagogue in the last week. There have been only slight variations in these figures over the last 2 decades, and the current figures are generally in line with Gallup's religious trends over this period. Americans are not as quite as religious today as they were in 1965. In particular, let's see, from 1950s to 1965. But they're still very religious. It's amazing. It reminds me of when Paul went to the Areopagus. Do you remember this story from Acts, 17, somewhere thereabouts? Paul is in Athens. He goes up to the center of culture, the center of thought, the center of religion, there in the capital of Greece, the center of the Greek world. He goes up. He takes a look around at what he sees, temples to every god, including the agnostic God, the unknown God, the God we think is out there, but we don't quite know who he is. And since we've got names for the rest of them, we don't know this one's name. We'll just call him the unknown God. The first thing Paul says to the men of the Areopagus is, I perceive that you are all very religious. It wasn't necessarily a compliment. It's open lines 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. I was visiting recently several websites. I found, strangely enough, surveys on several of these websites, including BeliefNet.com. There was one, a paper down south. This was last week. Three separate surveys on this subject. Do Christians and Jews and Muslims worship the same God? I'm always interested by this. Whenever there's a survey of this kind, I always vote, and then I immediately view the results because I want to know what's going on. Now, I've watched all three of these surveys unfold over the last several weeks because sometimes the initial results will change with time. In this case, they haven't. It's amazing. In an America where Gallup says we are as religious as we ever were, and 6 in 10 of us say that religion is very important in our lives, and of course that doesn't count the people who say that religion is moderately important or somewhat important in their lives. When you go into those questions, you're talking about 80% of us. When asked specifically, something just as... Now, it's not that specific. It's really a very general question. But do Christians, Jews, and Muslims worship the same God? There are four or five possible answers here. Yes, they all worship the same God. Christians and Jews do, but Muslims don't. Muslims and Jews do, but Christians don't. Christians and Muslims do, but Jews do not. And adherents of each faith worship a different God. Then there's I don't know, which always garners about 5% in any survey. What's your name? I don't know gets 5%. What was the top vote getter? They all worship the same God. How many people? Of 100? 56 of 100. Now compare this. 6 in 10 Americans believe that religion is very important in their lives. They've been to church in the last month. 6 in 10 Americans, almost exactly the same figure. When asked the question, of the major three monotheistic religions that are prominent here in the United States, not counting the unrespectable religions, do they worship the same God? The exact same number say yes. When we come back from this break, more open lines. Then, in 25 minutes, we'll be reviewing the best-selling book, The Da Vinci Code, with our guest, Dr. James Hitchcock of St. Louis University. Stay tuned for more open lines after this.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.